Well, I hope it's not necessary for me to tell you how much Pauline and I enjoy being here with you. We've anticipated, look forward to being here, and now it's here. We appreciate very much Ruth and her hospitality. We're being treated like royalty, and we appreciate every single thing that's been done to get us to come back and be here. And this is somewhat of a difficult subject. It took a lot of research, and while I was doing research for this, our modem was acting up at home, and we had to have a technician out twice before I actually was able to get back online and do some of the things that I wanted. But this is a growing problem for Americans, but it also presents a challenge for us as Christians. So we'll be looking at Islam. There'll be one or two nights that probably will speak on other things, but for the most part, we'll be talking about Islam this week. And I know Mark has material on that, probably stuff better than what I'll be doing, but I'll be looking at this as we consider not only the worldwide religion of Islam, but also how it affects us as Christians and as Americans. So I want to begin by going back. Actually, we have to begin by going back to Abraham, because let me get used to this. There are three great world religions that all center after Abraham, and it's a really a watermark so far as his life is concerned. That those who believe in Christ really go back to Abraham in a lot of ways, because he was the father of the faithful, and through his lineage the seed promise was given. And then there's the Jewish religion. There were descendants of that as well. And good morning. Come right in. Happy to see you. We're just beginning, and going back to Abraham is the beginning of Christianity, Judaism, and now to Islam. Most of us are really not familiar with Islam that much, but it goes back in its beginnings. In fact, they believe in the Old Testament to a large degree, like we do, in that they accept Adam as a prophet, they accept Noah, things of that nature. But it concentrates at Abraham, and from Abraham, much of the stuff that we'll be looking at will be going back to that. So this morning, I thought as an introduction, we could look at this from the standpoint of the beginning of these three world religions and be able to see exactly where we go from there. So looking at the early beginnings, first of all, the call of Abraham from Ur of Chaldeas was the beginning of this. And they went from there into modern-day Palestine, or modern-day Israel. And we'll look a little bit, first of all, at Abraham and the Jews, and then pass over that and begin with regard to Abraham and the connection then to Islam. But this will sort of lead us into our study. The idea was that they were shepherds, but they came from a place that was known for idolatry. And later on, I want to make a connection between the time of Abraham and Romans chapter 1. Because the Bible talks about the fact that there was a time in Romans chapter 1 when God gave up the Gentiles, gave them up. And from Abraham and his seed, people were called to be a special people. So the idea of the call of Abraham was very important with regard to these things. And they were following God's will. God told Abraham to leave his family and go to a place where he would show him, and then gave him the promises that he did. So the three promises that were made. I want to go to Genesis chapter 12. First of all, if you have a Bible, we'll have to go with me. When God called Abraham, he gave him really three promises that we need to look at. Now the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. As you look at this particular promise, the one in verse 3, you have the promise of the Christ. It's veiled at this point. It's one that you have to follow the line all the way through the Bible, but this is called the seed promise. And so the three promises that were made, and while we're there, let's go to Genesis 22. It was made again to Abraham and then later to Isaac, the same promises. And it has to do with the securing of the Jewish people. Genesis chapter 22, beginning of verse 15. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, says the Lord, Because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, as the sand which is on the seashore, and your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies. In you, in your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. This is the occasion when Abraham was told to offer Isaac upon the altar, and he was willing to do that. And when you look at this particular part of it, you have then the three promises given. First of all, the nation promise that he would have a multitude of descendants. It would be someone like the stars of the heaven or the sand by the seashore, innumerable. And then there was a land promise, the land that was given, the land of Canaan, that was promised to them. And finally, the seed promise. And the seed promise, as we've mentioned, is the promise that Jesus Christ was going to come of his seed. And we are particularly interested in that. But you began to get into early conflict with Abraham's lineage. First of all, you have the story of Abraham and Sarah, or at the time Sarai, and Hagar, and that Sarai could not have children. And we see how people get into trouble when they try to do God's business without asking God about it. Hagar and Sarah, particularly Sarah, thought that she was going to help God along because they were getting old and didn't have any children. So she was going to give Hagar, her handmaid, to Abraham to have a child, which she did. And that was the beginning of a lot of fighting going on. Hagar was the handmaid. And then, of course, the child that was born was Ishmael. And then later, they had Isaac as the child of promise that was given in their old age. Abraham was 100, Sarah was 90 when they had Isaac. So you see that the two heirs were at odds with one another. And this was the beginning of the conflict that continues to this day. The descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Isaac are still at war after all these centuries. And there's an animosity there that's sort of inbred in the sense that they hate each other and are trying to destroy each other. So this is what we have with regard to the beginning of that. Now the early conflict, I'm sorry, let me go the other direction. The early conflict was Sarah and Isaac and Hagar and Ishmael in Genesis 16 through verse 21. And that's too lengthy to read, but I'm sure most of you are familiar with that. The fact that Hagar was gloating against Sarah because she had a child and Sarah did not. And then after Isaac was born, there was further tension between the two. And Sarah said, she's got to go. And so that animosity was there. And Abraham was told by God to let Hagar go, that she and Ishmael would be taken care of. And in this very beginning of time, you have the beginning of the two nations that are very much in the news today. The Jewish nation through Isaac and the Arabic nation, today mostly Muslims, with regard to Ishmael. And that was something that is a point of conflict even today. Now, the Muslims believe the Bible has been corrupted, that Ishmael should have been the natural heir. And because of that, they say the Bible has been corrupted. But I want to go to the book of Galatians. As I said, we're going to be looking at this from the standpoint of how we as Americans should look at this. But also, we want to look at this from the standpoint of what as a Christian, we would look at the Islamic nation. So in Galatians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul uses an analogy with regard to Hagar and to Sarah and talks about the church in the process. Beginning in Galatians 4 and verse 22, for it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through promise, which things are symbolic. For these are two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which giveth birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is, and is bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all, for it is written, rejoice, O barren, you who do not bear, break forth and shout, you who do not travail. For the desolate has many more children than she who has a husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are, as Isaac was, are children of promise. So we are the spiritual Jews today. Galatians chapter 3 talks about the fact that when you're baptized into Christ, you become the heir of Abraham and heir according to the promise. So the Jewish nation is finished as far as God is concerned. He's not really concerned with the Jewish nation anymore. But the particular part of difficulty comes because the Islamic people believe the Bible has been corrupted. Now when you begin, and I have a copy of the Quran, and when you begin to read that, they'll tell you, first of all, you'll never be able to understand it unless you read it in Arabic. That has a certain tone, intonation that you'll not be able to understand if you don't know Arabic. But in any missal or manuscript, you can have a translation. And so you can really understand that, though they say you cannot. And they believe that the Quran is infallible as the Word of God. It cannot be mistaken, but that the Bible has been corrupted. Therefore, when in the Bible, when it talks about Abraham's heir being Isaac, that this is a corruption of the real story. They say the real heir was Ishmael, and that's the problem, that they refuse the Bible. Now, they believe the Bible is inspired, but they don't accept what the Bible actually says. So the genealogy of the Bible follows Isaac all the way through Joseph down into Egypt, and coming out of Egypt after the wilderness wandering, coming into the land of Canaan. So the genealogy of the Bible follows Isaac. But in the Egyptian bondage, you had deliverance by Moses during Exodus. And this was pretty much the story of Moses and the Ten Commandments and the giving of that. I used a little newspaper clipping here, which is sort of funny, Yahweh or the Highway, which was pretty much the idea of the Ten Commandments or the law of Moses given. And the first draft, if you remember, was broken because when Moses came back down off the mountain, the people were in a party mood and they were worshiping around the golden calf. So Moses, in his anger, threw down that the tablets that were engraved by the finger of God and broke them. But when Moses was told at the burning bush in Exodus 3 to go to Egypt and let my people go, he asked the question, who will I say told me to come down here? Who gave me my orders? And the phrase, I am that I am, just the phrase, I am, speaks of the existence of God. He always has been, he always will be, and he's always in the present. I am. And this was the one that was the be recognized as the name forever, the name of God, and that pretty much takes care of the Jewish role, because we understand that they went to Canaan and inherited the property that was told to them. But God promised Abraham and his family all the land between the river of Egypt, which is not the Nile, there's a smaller river called the River of Egypt, and the Euphrates River. And this is where you spend a lot of time in our Bible studies. Here's where we really study a lot about the land of Israel, the Assyrians who gave them much trouble, than the Babylonians and the Persians. And that's all this territory over to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. But the Arabs claimed their ancestry to Ishmael, and they would, of course, be down into the Arabic peninsula. The Jews claimed their ancestry to Isaac. And this is the reason, one of the reasons for the Arab-Israeli conflict, and that's been going on all these centuries. So when you watch the news, you'll pick up on this very clearly. The descendants of Ishmael despise and hate Israel, and they want them to be totally wiped out. You'll hear comments from Muslim people who will talk about destroying Israel. Now, Israel, for their part, would be willing to live at peace, but they're not allowed to under the circumstances of the hatred that's involved in that. So we go then to the Old Testament and the law and the prophets. And here's one point I want to really make with you that's important even for our knowledge. Go to Romans chapter 1 with me. And you're going to see in the book of Romans, Paul describing a period of time when he spoke of God giving up the nations. I believe that this is the very time of Abraham that we're studying this morning. That if you look, I'm not going to read all of Romans 1, but it speaks of the fact of the corruption of the world, the wickedness of the world in those days.
And beginning of verse 22, said, professing to be wise, they became fools, changed the glory of the incorruptible God unto an image made like corruptible man, birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness, to the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worship and serve the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women changed the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burning their lust for one another, men with men, committing what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error which was due. Now when you read this, it describes the time of Abraham. And at the time that God says he gave up the nations, that's when he called Abraham out of idolatry. The people around Abraham were full of idolatry. God called him out because he was a believer. Genesis 15:6 says that Abraham believed God and it was imputed to him for righteousness. So it was. I believe that the Bible chronology is the same with Romans 1 being described there as it was with the call of Abraham. We also see Sodom and Gomorrah in the time of Abraham, which was guilty of the crimes that are mentioned in chapter 1 of Romans as well. So historically, I believe that this was the very time that God gave up the nations and made up his mind that through Abraham he was going to save the world. So it's an important time of the history. And these were the nations gave up the knowledge of God. So the Hebrews or the Jews continued in monotheism, or the worship of one God. And the three promises are fulfilled. Jesus is the seed. Galatians 3:16 speaks of that as of seed, not plural, but one, the seed, which is Christ. So very clearly that's what's being spoken of there. And then in Acts chapter 2, the Jews reject their Messiah. You have the day of Pentecost and the fact that Peter and the apostles are preaching and declaring the will of God. And the Jews reject that to a large degree. And Peter speaks about that. Acts chapter 2, beginning of verse 29. Men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried. His tomb is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne. He, foreseeing this, spoke concerning the resurrection of the Christ, that his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God has raised up, of which we are witnesses. Therefore, being exalted to the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he poured forth this which you now see and hear. And so then in verse 36, therefore let the house of Israel know assuredly that God has made this Jesus whom you crucified, both Lord and Christ. Come on in, come right in. So we're looking at the beginnings, an introduction to Islam as we consider this. So the Jews reject their Messiah, and modern rabbinic Jews reject continually the Christ. Let me explain what I mean by rabbinic. In the Old Testament, the Jews were people of the book. They believed the law of Moses. When you come to the New Testament, Matthew 15, Jesus was speaking against the Jews because of the traditions that they followed. Well, the rabbis have written their traditions, and so a modern Jew is a rabbinic Jew, not an Old Testament Jew. And they are not really following the Old Testament. They follow the writings of the rabbis. So a modern Jew would be called a rabbinic Jew, and they have denied the Christ even today. And Galatians chapter 3, what you'll notice is the fact that Christians today are the real Jews. So to those that just came in, what we're looking at is sort of a history from Abraham on, because the three great religions of the world all have their origin with Abraham. The Jewish religion, of course, those of us who are Christians, and then also the Islamic religion. But in Galatians, let me get there, Galatians chapter 3, it has to do with the fact that Christians themselves are the real Jews today. In Galatians chapter 3, beginning of verse 26, for you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ, There is neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free, there's neither male nor female, for you're all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ, then you're Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So what I'm doing to this point is beginning with Abraham, and we see a mutual side-by-side comparison, as it is, with regard to the Jews and the Islamic people and the Christians, because we all look back to Abraham as the originator of some of the things that we hold very dear. Now, this finishes, though, our study of the Jews, because they give up Christ. They're no longer considered a part of the special people that were the Lord's. And the responsibility that Jews have today is like in Galatians chapter 3, that if they want to become the children of God, again, the select people of God, they have to obey the gospel just like we do. And so that pretty much takes care of modern Israel. They're no longer God's chosen people because of their rejection of the Messiah, and they still reject him. They became a nation in 1948 as they invaded what was the British and United Nations Emirate, or whatever you'd call it at that time, and became a nation. And it's purely a political state with a semi-religious activity. In fact, a lot of the Jewish people are atheists. You might not know that, but when you begin to inquire about what they do, many of them have a history of doing the traditional things like the Sabbath and Passover, those kinds of things. They recognize those holy days, but they're not at all doing it from the standpoint of how they were put into motion by God himself. And so there, it's more a political state than anything else. So we'll finish with the Jewish nation as we look at the three to begin with. You have Christianity, the Jews, and the Muslims. So now the Muslims continue their ancient hatred of the Jews, and you see that continuing. Our responsibility to Israel is found in Romans chapter 1. That is to preach the gospel, because the gospel is the power of salvation for all who believe, to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. So we do have a responsibility to the Jews to try to convert them to Christ. They're outside of Christ. They're not a special people anymore. And we have no obligation to them in a biblical sense. America looks at them as a nice political ally. They're the only democratic nation in that area that is a real ally of America. But so far as a biblical nation anymore, they're not anymore part of that system. So we've looked at some of the things having to do with Christianity, that the seed promise made to Abraham in Genesis 15 and chapter 22 as well, speak of the Christ who would come. We've accepted the Christ. We are spiritual Israel. But now, our thought this week is going to be a lot with regard to Islam, which means, by definition, submission to God. And a Muslim, then, is simply one who submits to God. Sometimes people get those two words confused, Islam and Muslims, but Muslim is the person who submits to God. Islam is the religion. Well, Muhammad was the founder of them, and so we'll be looking a lot at Muhammad this week, and you might spell his name in different ways, but we'll be looking at it like this. When he was born in Mecca. And Mecca was an idolatrous place. It had deteriorated into idols. And so when he was born into an idolatrous situation, but he accepted monotheism. There were still Jews in that area, and there were Christians, so-called Christians, in that area during that time, and he accepted monotheism. In 622, and we'll cover this more in detail later in some of our studies, but he was driven from Mecca. He believed that he was receiving inspirational messages from Angel Gabriel. And the messages to him was a morality that the idolaters did not possess and the belief in one God. He became an irritant to Mecca because he was telling people, you've got to stop idols, you've got to stop the immoral lifestyle of idolatry. And he irritated them enough that they tried to kill him, and he had to leave and go to Medina. And I'm pronouncing it the way I pronounce it, Medina, I'm not sure. But there he was accepted as a prophet, and it began to increase. They saw him as a messenger from God. So Muhammad is going to be the central figure of the Islamic religion, as we'll see. And they truly increased in a lot of numbers during that period of time. In a few years, he went back to Mecca with 10,000 of his followers. And as they came back to Mecca, he took Mecca by force. Here's one thing, historically, it cannot be denied. Historically, the Islamic religion has been spread by the sword. We hear a lot today about the Muslim religion being so peaceful. It is peaceful if you submit. If you do not submit, then they will try to kill you. We're seeing this in the news today. So I'm not saying anything that is different. It's just that way. When he came back to Mecca with 10,000 of his followers, they cleaned out the idols and forced them to accept monotheism or be killed. And they began to have all of that success in the Arabian Peninsula. That should be 10 years. Within 10 years, Islam had spread through Arabia. It was peace by coercion. You either accept Islam or you're going to die. And as they used the sword in those areas, they were used to that. And that's exactly what was going on in those days. Now, the role of Muhammad is something that's a mystery to most of us, because we think of Jesus Christ as the Son of God. But Muhammad did not see himself that way. In Islam, there can be no confusion or doubt that Muhammad was a man, and only a man, chosen by the Creator to fulfill the divine mission as a prophet. Muhammad's mission was literally to read or to recite. And that's one of the words that he uses, recite, what Allah had ordered and ordained, nothing more. So he saw himself as having visions or revelation from the angel Gabriel. And as he was considered a messenger, he had people around him all the time. And as he would recite what Allah had said to him, they would write it down on something or memorize it. During that period of time, there was a great deal of memorization going on among Arabic people. They really knew how to memorize things. And they would memorize the sayings of Muhammad. Now, the problem there is that we're supposed to receive the Quran as absolutely infallible. And yet, you recognize that for many years, it was simply recited by memory from one to the other. And I found out that to be somewhat unreliable. But the prophet received his revelations from God, sometimes in solitude, sometimes in the presence of others. Words flowed from his mouth in a way that others described as inspired. And this was Muhammad's divine inspiration or revelation. Muslims believe that the Quran is the word of Allah expressed through the revelations to the prophet. And the quotes that I've taken, many of the quotes, are from friendly places that are somewhat friendly toward Islam, and some are not, but you'll see that I'm trying to be accurate with the quotations that I make. Main thing here is to recognize that they do not recognize Muhammad as divine. He's simply a man, but a man that God chose to send Gabriel to, and through Gabriel he received these revelations. This is the Grand Mosque in Mecca, and you can see the people that are there. In the month of Ramadan, which is the ninth month of their calendar, they gather at Mecca in the Grand Mosque by the thousands, and in 1 month there'll be probably 2 million people go through that particular shrine, and they circle counterclockwise around that, and we'll talk more about the makeup of that later. But when you get down to Islam, there are five main pillars. And regardless of whether you're talking about the Shias or the Sunnis, which is a division within the Islamic group, they believe in this. This is what they believe is the pillars of Islam: their faith, their prayers, their almsgiving, their fasting, and their pilgrimage. So I want to look a little bit at each one of those, because these are basic things that will help you recognize what a Muslim believes in and what a Muslim practices, whether they're in America or whether they're in some other place. First of all, the pilgrimage to Mecca is something that every Muslim is expected to do if he's at all possible. At least one time in his lifetime, he's supposed to go on the pilgrimage over to Mecca and to be there in that shrine. They also believe in giving 2 to 2.5% of their wealth in almsgiving to the others. And you can tell from their giving that they're able to build their mosques. They're able to supply their terrorists with bombs and various things that they need to have. So they're very charitable toward the poor. Then they pray 5 times a day. And I would ask you to reflect upon yourself. How many times a day do you pray? And they would pray religiously 5 times a day. Sometimes I think we get carried away in our religion and we just sort of think, well, God understands, and we don't pray often enough. Daniel, it was said, prayed 3 times a day when he was in captivity. And so prayer is an important part of our worship to God. But they are to recite then their faith, and that is that there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. And that's the main tenet of their belief. Therefore, they will accept Jesus Christ as a prophet, but they will not accept him as the Son of God. And there's a distinction there as they look at Jesus Christ. And then they fast during the holy month of Ramadan. They fast during the daytime, not during the night. And these are the 5 things that you'll notice even in America that they're doing that characterizes their particular worship. And they'll go to the mosque on a Friday. That's their holy day. Whereas we consider Sundays the first day of the week. They do that on Friday. Within 5 blocks of our house, we have a mosque. And on Friday, they have a huge ingathering of the Muslims in our community. And you can hardly get through for the traffic during that period of time. But they do worship on Fridays. A profession of their faith, Muslims bear witness to the oneness of God. But by reciting the creed, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. This statement expresses Muslims' complete acceptance and total commitment to Islam. You'll hear that as they say it in Arabic. And they will sometimes say that even as they cut off someone's head. That this is central to them, that there's no God but Allah. I do not believe, though you look at them, they go back and they say they worship the same God as Abraham. Allah is not Jehovah. And I think I need to make that point. Though they would say that they accept Jehovah, they do not accept Jehovah as the Bible presents him, because they say that God does not have a son. He could not have had a son. And they did not believe in Jesus as the Son of God. And so when they began to talk about Allah, they made him in their own image. Then the prayer, the world's Muslims turn individually and collectively to Mecca. They always bow toward Mecca 5 times a day in their prayers at dawn, at noon, at mid-afternoon, at sunset, and in the evening. In addition, Friday congregational service is also required, as mentioned in my neighborhood. Then the almsgiving. Social responsibility is considered part of one's service to God. They are charitable toward other Muslims. And it's obligatory that 2.5% of their individual net worth is reserved for the welfare of the entire community, especially its neediest members. So you'll find them giving 2.5% of their wealth to their causes. Then the fasting during Ramadan. The fast is an act of personal worship of which Muslims seek a richer perception of God. It's also an exercise in self-control. In the New Testament, you find even the apostles on different occasions fasting and praying. Fasting is not something that we do. And we look at, of course, prayer as a part of our worship. I think it might be a good idea to look at fasting as some free will thing that we might do. If somebody wanted to give an exceptional study to the Bible or be in a period of stress, personal distress, it might be that we could examine the idea of fasting again to emphasize and put an emphasis on the spiritual part of man for a period of time and abstain from eating. I think most of us could profit from a little abstaining of eating, but nevertheless, their fasting is something that they do during that month. They abstain from eating, drinking, and sexual activity from dawn to sunset. At the end of Ramadan, they have 3 days of celebration, and they give gifts, and it's a time of family reunion. So Ramadan is really important to them, and you'll see this as they do their particular work during that. And then the pilgrimage to Mecca is tremendously important at least one time. If they're wealthy, they'll go more than once. But the idea of going to Mecca is important for them. And they're physically and financially able to make the journey once in their lifetime is the peak of their religious life. Now, some of us have gone to Israel. Those of us who study the Bible, we'd like to go on a group tour sometime over to Israel. And it's fascinating to go there where Bible things have taken place. I've done that. Others have done that. And it really makes the Bible come alive in some ways. So the Muslim feels the same way about Mecca. Because in Mecca, there's a granite block we'll be talking about in the mosque. And they believe that during the time of Abraham built that. Now, there's no historical record of that. But it was a granite block that was empty, and Abraham and Ishmael built that. And then after Abraham's time, it became a center of idolatry, and over 600 idols were inside that granite block. So when Mohammed built his following in Medina, he brought then the 10,000 back to Mecca and wiped out the idols. He was really important in doing monotheism. So he wiped out the idols. And that granite block is still there. We'll see pictures of it. And it's a very simple thing. They don't worship it, but it's a memorial to, they believe, Abraham and the creation of Islam. There again, you see in the lower right hand, that black obelisk is part of that mosque. And they go counterclockwise around that, and you can see how much they believe that that's important. The Kaaba is what it's called, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. The Kaaba is a semi-cubic building that stands about 15 meters high, 10 to 12 meters wide. It's an ancient, simple structure made of granite. In the southeast corner, there's a black meteorite, the black stone, embedded in a silver frame. Stairs on the north side lead to a door which allows entry to the interior, which is hollow and empty. During Muhammad's day, it was full of idols. And now that it's empty because they're not permitted there. It's covered with a black silk cloth that's embroidered with gold and redone and replaced once a year. Well, at the death of Muhammad, there was no clear successor. He's somewhat like Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great had no clear successor. And neither did Muhammad. And his close followers and personal companions led the movement for a period of time. They were called caliphates, and there were four of them, and I'm not trying to pronounce all of those, but there were four caliphates that led the Islamic union or religion during that period of time. These were called the rightly guided caliphs or imams, and they still have imams today as their religious leaders. And their primary concern during the time after Muhammad's death was to be sure that people kept the faith. Because there were what we today would call apostasies. And they were very concerned about someone believing something that Muhammad did not teach. And it was a very turbulent period during that time. They had murder, they had intrigue, with plots and counterplots and people killing each other. And during those caliphates, it was a violent time when they used the sword. I want to emphasize that because the history of Islam is a history of violence. Now, even our president said recently, after they beheaded one of the reporters, that this was not Muslims doing this. These are radicals doing that. Well, I want to show you during this period of time of study together that they're not radicals. They're people who believe the Quran. And the Quran itself teaches this, so that if a Muslim majority becomes true, such as in Dearborn, in Detroit, some of those places today, they invoke Sharia law, which is the Islamic law, and they live outside the laws of America. So when we look at this, I want you to understand that the idea of the sword and cutting off people's heads and cutting off their hands, this is nothing new. This is something that's always been true with regard to Islamic religion. They forced their beliefs upon others with a sword. And to say today that it's peaceful is to be, we need to understand, it's peaceful if you accept it. if you don't accept it, then you're in trouble, of course, and that will be part of it. So there was a lot of violence going on during that period of time. Then after Mohammed died, Muslim, is about time?
Yeah.
My land. It continued to develop over a period of time. It was called the religion of peace, the word salam, which is close to the Jewish word shalom. It was extended by the sword, but the right of succession led to a major division. I want to make this point, and then we'll close this part of it. The differences today that you read about, what is the difference between the Shia and the Sunni Muslims? You'll see that in the newspapers. Well, basically, it's a matter of leadership. Both Sunni and Shia Muslims share the fundamental beliefs. The differences are simply with regard to who is going to have the power. And the Shias believe very clearly that it should be the followers of the descendants of Muhammad that should rule. Others believe the most capable is going to rule. And the Shia and the Sunni will kill each other. What you have going over in the Middle East today, a lot of it is these two groups are fighting each other. They kill one another. And it is simply the idea of Islamic peace. You're going to worship the way I do, or you're going to die. And if you're dead, it's going to be peaceful. And if you accept me, it's going to be peaceful. But we're going to have peace one way or the other. So when you hear the newspaper accounts, you're going to be hearing about Sunnis and Shias fighting each other. And that's what it's talking about. The difference is it's a question of leadership. And so you have those two different groups. As we look at this, we're going to be looking at some of these things. What are the origins? Islam and Christianity compared. That's our particular interest in this. Major beliefs of Islam. We'll be looking at the Quran itself. What is the Quran? Then how do we respond? And I'm going to combine these for the sake of time, some of them. And then is Islam a religion of peace? So we'll be looking at these things as we continue our studies.